Today's program was brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Today, I am lucky enough to be sitting in the studio with Jimmy Carbone of Beer Sessions Radio.
Hi, Ann. It's nice to be on your show.
It's nice to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us. And I'm here with Greg Blaze, who is the buyer and cheesemonger extraordinaire over at Eataly. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me, always.
And we are sitting here surrounded. We've got six beers on a table and four cheeses, and we are going to just throw down and do a beer and cheese pairing show, which we've never done before.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's fun is that I've never met Greg, but we have so many buddies, and the roots of what we're talking about, first, I'm feeling totally intimidated because I'm with you guys, you cheese, serious cheese.
No way. No, come no on, way.
You know that everything that I've done started with you, Ann, and you know that. Because...
Well, yeah, when we did... When we launched the cheese and beer project, I feel like our businesses started right around the same time. And we would do these crazy beer and cheese nights down in the basement. We would do cheese and beer and chocolate pairings even sometimes with Mary Izette and Chris Kuzmi, who all have another show now, Foment About It, here on the network. And yeah, those were the days, man.
It was really, I mean, I think, I don't know if Greg can appreciate it, but when you open your shop, before that, there was no one in New York doing just Northeast regional artisanal farmstead cheeses. And, you know, what was cool before that was, oh, yeah, there's a new cheese from Spain. There's a new cheese from Italy. But you just changed everything that I did. And now I only serve American cheeses.
Man. Thanks, Jimmy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, today, actually, so I have to say, we've got three Wisconsin cheeses that we're playing with here. We've got some Pleasant Ridge Reserve, which is a perennial favorite.
Always.
We've got a Hook's one-year-age cheddar, yellow cheddar, which is great. It's a classic, you know, Midwestern cheese like me. And then we've got some Bohemian Blue, which is a sheep's milk blue from Hidden Springs Creamery. And then Greg brought us a special treat from Eataly.
I brought you some Gorgonzola Picante from Luigi Gufanti. What I call 200-day Gorgonzola.
From Gufanti. We visited those caves together last September.
That was a great time.
Yeah, good times. And so, Jimmy, tell us a little bit about the beer selection that you brought today. And you know, we were talking a little bit before the show. You know, of course, I decided to focus on local cheese when I got into the biz. And now you're talking about another emphasis on local grains and brewing. So let's talk about that, too.
Well, let me segue into that. We're actually recording today. It's the kickoff of Beer Week. So technically, I'm celebrating Beer Week on Cutting the Curve with Ann Saxby and Greg Blaze. So I'm super psyched. I don't know when you're going to air the show, but just so you know, to me, this is my choice. What am I doing on the kickoff for New York City Beer Week? I'm with Ann Saxby. And so one of the features of the week, this for what I'm doing, I'm working with Grow NYC's Regional Grain Project. And June Russell, who's been on a lot of the shows on Heritage Radio Network, she's really been behind that. And one of the key things is getting New York farmers to you know, have value-added products, whether they're making cheese or pickles or cider, ways for them to continue to grow and keep their businesses growing and their communities growing. And Grow NYC has been behind this regional grains project. So they're trying to encourage certain farmers to grow traditional grains. And what do you do with those grains? Well, obvious thing is they sell them whole or they make flour. But then with the project we're on now, it's growing grains for beer that can be malted. And malt is important flavor component of beer, you know, and we're doing an event with that. But the other part of that is people actually, after they make beer, they feed the spent grain to animals. And it's common to feed it to pigs, and you can get a spent grain fed pig. But when I was I think the reason why you brought this up is when I was in Amsterdam a few years ago and I was at this Brouwerij Eijge, which is the egg brewery. It's a beautiful windmill brew pub in Amsterdam. Mm. And they were feeding their spent grain to a sheep farmer in the other side of Amsterdam. And he was making a sheep's milk camembert, which then he gave back to the brewery and they would serve. So you would just get a little round of beautiful sheep's milk camembert with your beer at this brewery. So I didn't know if anyone in the Northeast was feeding their sheep or other dairy animals spent grain.
And we couldn't come up with anything. Well, Greg, you knew of one story.
The only thing I have ever heard of that in my time doing this like that is when I was buying Isle of Mull cheddar back in the days, like 15 years ago, the rumor was, and what I was being told is that they were feeding the animals the leftovers, the sour mash from the whiskey making process. I mean, the only pigs get fed everything, you know. I know that they get fed the whey from the Parmigiano process so that they get turned into meat, but I've never heard of it being the opposite, you know, I just have never heard of that, you know, and I don't know if you have, but
yeah, no, I haven't. You know, in fact, you know, the only story that I heard was actually sort of a bad story. You know, when we actually one of the first shows that I did on the network, it was probably like 3-4 years ago now, was about the history of pasteurization and the kind of urban-rural dairy connection,
sure,
because those things were tied. And when there used to be breweries in the city and there used to be cows in the city because milk was too perishable to transport, then they would feed the spent grain to the cows, but fed a diet exclusively of that, you know, that wasn't good for them. I'm sure a little bit is great. It could add some nice flavor to the milk. It could add a little fat to their diet.
But it's kind of there's not a – I don't know. I'm a terrible scientist. But, I mean, like, it doesn't sound like there's a lot of benefit to feeding them. Wouldn't that be kind of like feeding them filler, you know, or like feeding them – I don't know. What would be the nutritional advantage of feeding them
that? Yeah, well, I guess, you know, a lot of animals get grain, though. I mean, like, grass is definitely the basis of the diet. And then grain kind of acts as like a – like you said, like to help them be a little – fatten up a little bit, you know.
But if they're – like I said, I don't know what – what's left after you make beer? You know, what's left in there for them to?
We gotta get a scientist in here to tell us.
Yeah, I mean, who knows that? But you know, it's spent grain is kind of like the mash as well. It's just after they take out the nutrients from
that's
the grain,
what I'm
I
saying.
Guess.
So it's like distilled water, filler, right? Yeah. It's kind of like drinking. Like, so, like, what's the benefit of feeding them that unless you don't have anything else to give them? I don't know though. I'm not a farmer. So
I think it must be animal by animal because I definitely know for pigs as part of their diet, it's fine. And you know, a lot of times I've had a meal with a spent grain fed pig, but it's just going back to this brewery in Amsterdam. I mean, feeding the sheep. I don't think they were fed exclusively the spent grain.
Yeah,
but I think that
it made up a part of
it.
The
made
diet.
A circle, so
right? That's
so,
what I mean. Like, so, yeah. Like, if you needed to do that, you would do that. But I know that at the end of like the life cycle of certain hogs, you know, in Spain they feed them the acorns, you know, so that because of the way that because of the fat that's produced by eating of those acorns and you know imparts some flavor. But I don't know, that's an interesting question. Like beer, the only way that I deal with beer is it's on the cheese. It's been washed with the cheese.
Exactly.
You know, it's been washed
or soaked.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. So that's interesting though. I mean, that's I'd like to find that out. I'd like to know that.
I think that's going to be another show. We got to make that. Yeah. We'll have a follow-up with like a, you know, an animal nutritionist here in the studio, and we can find out what's the advantage. And I feel like the more dairy animals there are, the more brewers there are in an area, the more likely those partnerships are to crop up. And up until this point, there probably hasn't been as big of an opportunity to do that. So it'll be exciting.
If you're going to feed animals something, there has to be a reason. You know, I mean, you're not going to – like, I can eat whatever I want. I can walk into a – you know, eat a whole bunch of things I don't need to eat. But, you know, I don't know if that makes any sense. You know, we give it to them for a specific
reason.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of feeding animals, let's feed ourselves.
Sure.
And so, Jimmy, you poured us a beer. Tell us a little bit about this beer, and then we can talk a little bit about the cheeses that might or might not go with it.
Well, what was cool is that when I knew I was coming on your show, Greg suggested three of his favorite – beer and cheese pairings. So one was a blue vein cheese, and he'll tell you which were the three cheeses that you picked.
Well, I liked firm cheeses with the session beers, like Alpine cheeses, like Pleasant Ridge Reserve, or cheddar, you know, with those beers. I liked With the farmhouse ales, I really liked washed rind cheeses, and I should have brought one, but it would have made me smell really bad on the subway, so I didn't. And then with those like sort of darker, sugary beers, I really liked blue vein cheeses.
And nice. That's kind of a good rule of thumb, I feel like, you know?
I mean,
because beer and cheese pairing can be tricky, you know? So that's like a nice sort of just basis to go from.
What I learned, I started doing beer and cheese pairings in like 2003 or so with my friend Joe at Spite and Dival. I would go there, bring cheese from the Bedford Cheese Shop, and we'd sell them. We did a couple classes, and it was fun. And I thought it was easier because I've done a shitload of wine and cheese courses. And the original brewer at Eataly, my friend Brooks Coretta.
Brooks is awesome.
He's a killer guy. So we taught a beer and cheese class together, and he wrote on this smudge board in giant letters, cows don't eat grapes. And I thought that was like a great rule of thumb for why beer and cheese go together really well.
Truer words have never been spoken. That's awesome. Yeah, no, there's, well, let's dig in. Let's see. So what's this beer that we have here?
Well, so I starting with session beers, I just went through the beer cellar at Jimmy's number 43 in the East Village, which is my little pub where Ann and I first met many years ago.
Between second and third.
And I picked out two of my favorite session beers. So by session, it usually means, you know, something that's, you know, not too strong and easy to drink. And one of my favorites, it's making a comeback. You know, before communism in the Czech Republic, the style of beer was about a 6% malt forward, you know, kind of a lager. And we're drinking that now. It was a style that, when you've had so many hops and there's IPAs and things, it's a beautiful style because, you know, malt is it, whether it's from grains, malt is the building block of beer in addition to water. So if you have a really nice malt and you're able to, a brewer who can work that way, it's definitely layers of flavor. It's kind of, I think malt is akin to grapes in wine, going back to wine. So the if you know how to work with your malt, what I'm trying to say is that to get a really good malty lager around 6% is amazing beer. It's one of my favorite styles now. And it's something that in the Czech Republic before communism, this was a style. It wasn't Pilsner Raquel. It was these very beautiful 6% malt beers. So that's what I brought as a session beer.
It's nice because it's definitely light, like you said, you know, it's definitely light, but it has like a really rich character because of that malt. I liked what you said before the show. You were saying someone once taught you taste malt before hops.
Yeah.
Which I think, and were you referring to like you want to taste malty beers before hoppy beers, or just in general the malt comes forward in the palate more than the hops?
Well, there's a really dynamic fellow named Stefan Mars, and he has a family-owned brew pub in Bamberg, which is the heart of malt-growing region of Germany.
It's amazing there.
And he did a tasting with us once, and you know, he put all his malty beers first, so it wasn't I used to think, oh, you would just taste, you know, like from lighter to stronger, you know, alcohol percentage. So, and he blew me away because he started with, oh, he had like a wheat beer and a Bock and things that were just more malt forward. And then he had a 2.5%, a very light beer that actually had a little bit of hops to it, as Mars licked. And I was like, wow, it popped. The hops popped in my mouth. So I think that hops are like almost an extreme flavor. And we think of craft beer as having, you know, hops as being so important. But so many of my customers, more and more, they're like, no, I want the malt flavor. So that's why I brought this beer.
I'm not a huge IPA fan.
I'm not either.
I enjoy, like, you know, I like Sierra Nevada, like whatever. You know, I can enjoy an IPA. But generally, I don't like that super resiny kind of crazy flavor, you know?
I remember when there was only, you know, when I was in college, you know, I could just get like Harpoon IPA, and I drank a shitload of them because they were cheap and they were great. But I think I agree with you. But then when I went over and I traveled to Germany, and I started drinking I started drinking malty beers, I was like, oh, this is, I don't know how to describe it as well.
And last night actually there's a larger but still a very quality oriented brewery. Also in Germany, it's called Kulmbacher. It's in Kulmbach. It's a town a little north of Franconia. We were drinking last night the Monschhof Keller. Again, it was a malt-forward beer. And the reason I'm talking about the malt is that for, you know, your typical cheese pairings or with wine, I think that hops do throw off the food pairings. And I've always felt that certain German beers really do better with food. So I think if you really want to do beer and cheese pairings, I think that more malt-oriented beers will probably be something you can play with more than just extreme hop beers.
Yeah. See, I don't disagree, but I think that more I think that wine and cheese, you know, get more play, that people talk about it more, and it's more, I don't know what the hell it is, but it gets more play.
It's like slightly cooler, I guess.
But I know that.
I think it's more widely accepted, beer and cheese is cooler.
Yeah, and it also goes better.
Bougie,
I don't know.
It's bougie.
Yeah, exactly.
Wine pairings. Have you ever been to a wine tasting class?
Oh, I've bougie.
I've taught several. I mean,
I've
witnessed
them. Yeah.
I mean, I can teach them pantless if you want me to, like, you know, to get them.
Now, Greg and I
that's
have
a different kind of class. That's like the bachelorette party version.
Greg and I have beards. So.
I don't think I'd be hired out for any bachelorette party ever. But I think that cheese eaters, I know, like, especially people before the movement of artisan cheese began in earnest, and, like, you know, not that it ever hasn't been there, but before it was popularized, I think beer and cheese, my dad loved to have cheese with his beer, you know what I mean? And just back when we had just cheddar and he was drinking, like, Schlitz or something like that, you know what I mean?
So. Cheddar and Schlitz, the classic. Well, you know, for this particular beer, I did like the cheddar a little bit better.
Yeah, me too.
I don't know about you guys, but the cheddar's easy. Perfect. It's only aged a year, so it's really...
it's got a nice sweetness, got fudgy texture. It's really...
Yeah. Damn. A little gentle sharpness.
So this is the orange cheddar?
Yeah, the Hook's one-year cheddar. So the Hook's cheese is a great company. They're in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Tony and Julie Hook are the owners. I believe their son's in the business now. They've been doing this since the 70s. So they're classic, you know, old school Wisconsin cheesemakers. They're cheddars, they're blues. And then they actually branched out. They do a lot of interesting different cheeses too, and they've always got funny names. We got a blue in recently from them called You Calf to Be Kidding Me, which had cow, goat, and sheep milk in it, which is really funny. But yeah, no, so it's really delicious cheese.
Can you say that again, Ann?
You Calf to Be Kidding Me. well, listen, it's time to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to revisit some of these other pairings. We're going to drink a little bit more beer, eat a little bit more cheese, so stay with us.
Cool.
Today's break song is called Relax, It's Just the End of the World by TacStar, and you are listening to Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program was brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 160 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
All right, and we are back on Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. I'm here with Jimmy Carbone, who is the host of Beer Sessions Radio and also the proprietor of Jimmy's Number 43.
Hey, hey, hey.
Excellent beer pub in the East Village in New York City. And Greg Blaze, who is my good buddy and the cheesemonger and cheese buyer at Eataly.
What's up?
So we're talking about beer and cheese today, specifically Wisconsin cheeses. We have a nice spread of Wisconsin cheese and an Italian counterpart that Greg has brought us. Jimmy, we're moving along. We moved on from the session beers, and now you're having us try a smutty nose. What do we have here?
Well, so we're basing this on Greg's recommendations for some of his favorite beer and cheese pairings. We're moving up to, for his blue vein cheese, he suggested a dark malty beer. He recommended Dogfish Head's the Palo Santo Marone, which is strong and unfiltered in brown ale and caramelly. So from the cellar at Jimmy's Number 43, I bought a new beer from Smutty Nose, which is in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And it's actually called, I'm going to grab the bottle.
Sorry.
it's the Dirty. It's a mud season hoppy brown ale. And it's strong. It's like 9%. So the last beer we had was malty. This actually has a lot of hop character, but the hop is kind of... It's like balanced by the strength of the beer and like this dark caramel sugar thing.
Yeah.
It's almost like a Belgian beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like a strong Belgian beer that where they add these candied sugars and hops. It's almost like this is almost like a 19th century kind of pre-prohibition style beer.
This is like very nice, very intense, very rich, very you know, it's a little spicy, a little caramely, like you said, dark and sugary. And then with that gorgonzola.
It's good, right?
Holy moly. Yeah. The gorgonzola is so thick and dense and fudgy.
But it's I don't know, I think it's the two just marry well together. Just it's all that all that richness of the cheese, and you know, and the sweetness that comes out of the gorgonzola, and just the fudge, that really dense texture of the gorgonzola. I don't know.
And we're gonna try it with the Bohemian Blue too, because for me, you know, the sheep's milk blues always have like a touch of a caramely sweetness to them.
That.
And I feel like it could be.
Out of the cheese that I wanted to bring a cheese called Arborunati di Pecora, which is which is my favorite cheese pair. But I'm sure this will be the same.
Now, what does Arborunati mean? I should know that at this point in my cheese
blue.
Career.
It's blue.
It's just blue.
But I mean, Arborunata.
Oh, so it's like persillé. In French means parsley. Yeah. Arborunati means herbed.
Because my Italian is as bad as everything else I know, one of the words that word could also mean parsley if there's an A, I believe, on the end of it. So
there you go. So again, in French, persillé is the name of many blues because it looks like there's parsley inside and Arborunati. I like it. Thanks, man. Thanks for the education. We're just
that's good together.
Eating, drinking, learning. This is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
But I always liked Wisconsin cheeses. Years ago, we did a Wisconsin beer and cheese pairing, and I'm so glad you have Wisconsin cheeses today.
Yeah, no, they're great. You know, fantastic. And I like them because they range from like the super classic style. You know, like the basic cheddars, Colby's, Jack's. You know, things that. I feel like a lot of people turn their noses up at, but are just really delicious, and they have their place in the cheese 100%. Canon, and they make you happy. And then there are kind of newer style cheeses, you know, like the Pleasant Ridge Reserve. The Bohemian Blue that we're trying is actually a nice hybrid because it's a sheep's milk blue. It's in kind of a Roquefort style, but it's kind of like Roquefort meets Maytag. You know, it's rindless, but it has more of like that vinegary quality that you would find with the Maytag blue. And this cheese is actually made at Hook's. So Hidden Springs is a creamery that's just a little bit west of Madison, owned by Brenda Jensen and her husband.
They make good feta.
They make great feta. Make great sheep's milk cheeses. And then for the blue, I think because they need a special aging facility, et cetera, to really ripen this cheese. So they partnered with Tony and Julie over at Hook's, and they said, hey, we've got this recipe. Will you guys make the cheese for us? So I like that about Wisconsin, too. I feel like there's a lot of information sharing, infrastructure sharing.
Friendliness.
Friendliness. Got that good Midwestern friendliness. You know, fueled by cheese.
We're a little more crusty in the Northeast.
It's so true. It's so true.
We're just a little crusty.
I've lived here long enough. I've lived here for 15 years
But we're nice
now.
Underneath, you know what
it's
I mean?
It's true. You got to scratch the surface a little bit.
I mean, if your like, car breaks down in the snow near your house in New England, we'll like yell at you for being stupid. But we'll take you in and give you a cup of coffee.
Exactly. Help shovel you out.
Exactly.
So what are the other things that we should think about here, Jimmy? I feel like you're our beer steward. You're our navigator here.
Well, I'm digging the blue cheeses.
Do you like that pairing?
I do. And I actually I'm just delving more into classic beer and food pairings. It's something that I want to start doing more at Jimmy's Number 43, and we may pitch a book on it, which is kind of fun because we've been doing beer and food pairings since we met you, 2006. We have so many lists, but one of the favorite that stands out, it's similar to this, Garrett Oliver, who still inspires me with his Brewmaster's book. It was about cooking and beer. His favorite pairing is it's like a good barley wine, which this almost is. It's like a strong, you know, darker beer with a Stilton.
Yeah, it's perfect.
And it's really when you put them together, it's like but the barley wine with the Stilton to me is the perfect pairing because it all melts together in your mouth.
We sell him that when he was a customer of mine in Williamsburg a long, long time ago, and I remember having him tell me that same thing, you know.
And when you meet Garrett Oliver, he says something and he says it with authority.
Dude,
you
that
know?
Guy was
you don't
he
question.
Was so nice
You're
to
like,
me.
Okay,
he like threw me a keg of beer for a Super Bowl party.
Wow, that's awesome.
But, you know, if you because when I'm thinking about, I'm trying to learn too, like what are classic beer and food pairings or beer and cheese pairings?
And now, how do you go about that? I mean, do you go kind of by region? You know, you're talking about these classical styles of beer from Czech Republic and from Germany. I'm sure that those are tied to local cuisines from back in the day. So, are you kind of basing your pairings on that, or more kind of a modern twist?
I think that I'm still learning, but I think that Greg has probably had more experience doing it than I have.
Well, I mean, in the things that I've seen, especially at the Benedia, there's a lot of classics, you know? And I mean, I go by the philosophy of like, there's things that come from the same place go well together, you know?
And but which is weird for America because we're making all this shit up as we go.
Yeah, but well, yeah, that's true.
But
you're
so
still using ingredients. But some, well, yeah, that's true, actually.
We still kind of use, I feel like we use Europe as a crutch because, you know, we say, Now we're producing European style prosciutto, say in Virginia.
So are we like, have we grown out of like our toddler phase and now we're like
adolescents.
Pimply faced kind of kids.
So. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But I think, you know, that's the cool thing. Just like Jimmy was talking about the regional grain project, as these industries grow up, we will start to see more of those local affinities for different products.
I mean, I always just go back to what I remember from when I was a kid. I remember when I was a kid, and I'm a Swede, and I'd be with my parents at the Swedish club, and you know, and they would, you know, you'd see beer, and then we'd have a barbecue. You know what I mean? So I was eating like roast chickens and do whatever. And the first time I went to Munich, you know, I went down there, and what did they have? Like they had like a hen and beer. I don't know. It was just, I think that no matter what, you never get too, or you shouldn't get too far away from the old stuff that works.
No, it's fun for me because I know both Ann and Greg, you guys have done so many of these cheese tastings and things, and I'm at the point now I just want to explore. So it's like I want to bring out a couple of different beers in a similar style to see how they go with a cheese or a food pairing. On an off note, we had a dinner recently at Jimmy's Number 43, and the Brussels sprout course had a little too much crushed red pepper, and it threw off the pairing. Yeah. But then we also had this nice Flemish like sour. And some of the regular customers said, you know what, it actually tastes better with the sour. And so part of it is for me is I don't know the set pairings. It's more like exploring it. It's what we're doing right now. We have – there's two other courses too, and we jumped it because we're running out of time. But, I mean, Greg hit it on the nose. He was like, well, my other favorite pairing is like kind of a wash rind cheese with farmhouse ale. So we brought two different kind of farmhouse ales.
What's the one we're drinking right now?
Right now this is such a cool beer. It's actually Dutch. It's another like stronger, you know, brownish beer. It's like a kind of caramel flavors. It's called De Doctor Van der Corinar. I call it Embrasse. These cool kids out of Brooklyn, 12%. Brian Ewing, he imports it. And it's like, to me, it fit what he was talking about. It's
a
kind of...
That has a little bit more of a warmth to it to me. It has like some like spice that you get in like a pumpkin pie or something.
Yeah, easily.
It goes, I really like this one with the Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I feel like even though it's not like your typical wash rind, you know, like it's not a stinky wash rind, the rind is washed as the cheese ages. And so there is a hint of that pungency, that wininess, that fruitiness that I think is just really nice with this beer.
And it's funny, I was thinking the same thing. And that's really what I can do is just, you know, get a bunch of quality cheeses and a quality beers and sit down and have your own cheese and beer party, right?
I mean, they all go
with Ann Saxelby, which is always awesome.
Well, no, awesome for me. But yeah, I always say that too. I'm like, hey, if the beer's good, if the cheese is good, chances are you're going to find some great pairings. Are there some like rules that usually work? Yes. But, you know, you're always going to find something unexpected.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm, so good. So good. All right. Well, since we're running out of time, we got a couple more minutes. Do you want to try one more beer here before we
sure.
wrap up?
I mean, or? We can go back. Well, you know, let's. I actually wouldn't mind hearing more about your cheeses because it's so much fun. I mean, what's Greg? What's the one that you brought?
I brought a Gorgonzola, you know, blue vein cheese from you know from the northern part of Italy, from Lombardia. It's cow cheese. It's marginally pasteurized, I guess, you know, inoculated with a nice culture, not a Roquefort culture or another type of a penicillin culture.
And now the Gorgonzola, too, has kind of a fun twist to the cheese make process, because if I'm not mistaken, I think that the Gorgonzola is always made, or maybe you can tell me, Greg, I think back in the day it was always made from a blend of two different curds.
Yes, it was.
There was curd that was made from one day's milking.
Yes.
It was allowed to sit in the vat overnight. And then when they would make cheese the next day, they would make another batch of curd, mix those two curds together, and then that would be your Gorgonzola. So is that still the way that it's made?
You know, to be honest with you, that particular Gorgonzola comes from a really small producer, so I'm sure that they might adhere to those, you know, to those principles.
We got to call Giovanni.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Gio, I mean, I'll say this, that particular Gorgonzola is my favorite one, and it's got the truest flavor and the best texture. So I would say 99% of the producers of Gorgonzola or blue cheese in northern Italy don't adhere to that anymore.
Because it's just not efficient.
No, and that's what, I mean, you know, that's what the world's become about.
Yeah, I know. Well, I just learned that Peter Dixon, who's a great cheesemaker, I always call him the Johnny Appleseed of the cheese world in America. He's he's taught so many people so many great things about making cheese on his West Blue.
Yeah,
that he's just come out with Paris Hill Creamery. He's doing that mixed curd Gorgonzola style recipe with that. So if anyone's curious, you can check it out at Eataly.
Absolutely, that's a great cheese.
Yep, we have a little bit at the shop as well. So very cool. Yeah,
and I was wanted to ask you this question. Well, first of all, at Jimmy's Number 43, our cheese program now the last couple of years is exclusively. And, you know, someone in your shop at Saxby Cheesemonger just picks a couple of cheeses and sends them to us each week. And sometimes customers
we
ask
love
me,
doing that.
They say, what are the cheeses? And I say, you know, actually, that Saxby Cheesemonger curates a cheese plate, and I stop keeping track, but I love them so much. So that's good and bad, but that's what I do. But the other question is, if you had to say what cheese would you eat every day, this is like that dumb question that people ask, but what style of cheese would or could you eat every day?
Oh, man, that's
and
so tough.
And Greg, too.
That's so tough.
You know, I get asked that a lot, actually, because I'm sitting out there at a cheese counter like 75% of my life. So.
Yeah. I feel like for me, it kind of changes with the season. I mean, to be honest with you, it changes every day. You know, my favorite. Yep. You know, you'll just hit one that you're like, oh, my God, that's so great. But I would say, like, in general, like, you know, warmer times of the year, I want to eat, like, those beautiful French-style goat cheeses. I have a real soft spot for those. So those are
Loire River Valley cheese.
Oh yeah, yeah, beautiful. This time of the year, I like an Alpine cheese. You know, sure. Like Mountaineer from Meadow Creek Dairy or Pleasant Ridge Reserve here, or something a little bit more pungent and stinky like the Windermere from Jasper Hill Farm. But yeah, what do you think, Greg?
If I had to whittle it like down, I would say something that I would keep with me forever anywhere I went would be sheep's cheese from the Pyrenees Mountains. Those are just the best for me. The texture and just like the subtle like nuances of flavor. It appeals to all palates, you know, both refined and you know, and the less adventurous. It's just
novice, yeah.
It's just sturdy, you know what I mean? Just sturdy stuff. It makes me feel good when I eat it. I don't know. That's where I'm at.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yeah, I agree. That cheese can be eaten anytime, all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like green eggs and ham.
Yep.
Yeah. We should write a cheese book like that.
I'd like to do that.
Yeah. Well, it looks like we are almost out of time here. Any final thoughts about beer and cheese pairings? Jimmy, tell us about Beer Week. What's happening in Beer Week?
Well, by the time you hear the show, Beer Week will be over. But what's so cool is that, again, thanks to Grow NYC and the Regional Grains Project, we're having over 20 brewers in the New York region making special beers with New York State grain. And the next question for next time is, are there any dairy farmers feeding their sheep, you know, spent grain, and are they going to make cheeses? Which would be fun, because next year we'll bring in that.
To this show, somebody will, you know, take the initiative. Yeah, we'll see.
Could share them, yeah.
Well, Greg, you put the word out. I'll put the word out. We'll see
Absolutely.
What we can do. Yeah.
I'd love to.
Well, thank you guys for being on the show. It was always a ton of fun. And,
thanks so much.
This was delicious and wonderful. And we'll see you again soon.
Right on.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.